Welcome, everyone. I'm Chris Sharon. I teach at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota in the summer with my wife, Sonia, who's holding down Rebel Row upstairs. I am helping coordinate the teaching staff this summer, which has been a wonderful gift. And mostly I haven't been teaching, but Paul Jacobson and I have been talking for years about trying to do a class together that brought together his interest in Baroque and Renaissance music and my interest in 20th century popular music. And this is the summer, so we're trying to do it around this title of Music in the Midst of Life. And partly thinking about the relationship between the lives of people who make the music and the music they make, but also thinking about our own engagement with music and what's meaningful to us about music, or in the case of the blues, what might be reprehensible in music, what might be represented in music that offends us. On Thursday, I'm going to do hip-hop, making the argument that hip-hop is the new blues. And that's another genre of music that's contested in terms of its enduring value, shall we say. So what I want to do to pose this question, is the blues the devil's music, or is it faithful cries, is get us talking a little bit about our associations with the blues and how we make sense of that genre of music and how it matters in our lives. And spin out a little bit the story of how that came to be in the life of this fellow, Robert Johnson, who's one of the most well-known blues players, and then in the life of Eric Clapton, who generations later picked up Robert Johnson's music in a totally different cultural context and made something, I think, quite different of it. So those two life stories give us a way to talk about this question of whether it's the devil's music or not, and what it even means that people talk about it in that way or in other ways that they talk about it. So that's what I want to open with, and then we'll end our time together looking at a case study of a blues musician writing a really famous faithful song, Thomas A. Dorsey writing Precious Lord, and talk about our own experiences, if people have experiences of suffering or great joy in the song that is associated with that for you. This song, Precious Lord, came out of a very specific sorrowful event in his life. And I think for many of us, those profound moments, whether they're moments of joy or sorrow, often are connected with songs, or when we reach a moment like that, the death of a loved one or something, we'll want a certain song played. So that's the territory I'd like to go through today. And I want to start just by having you talk with, I don't know, whoever's nearby enough that you can talk to them about how you'd finish the sentence, when I think of the blues, I... So tell one another, a couple people near you, how you finish that sentence and why. What are your associations with the blues? Robert Johnson is calling us back from the small group conversation, singing Walking Blues. Well, let's take a minute out of your conversations and just create a what are those called when you take something and it's a wordle. Have you seen those? Mm-hmm. Where you can take an article or an internet site or a book and then it pulls together all the themes and puts them in kind of a picture. That's what I want to metaphorically do. Put together a group picture of associations with the blues. What did you say when you asked that question? When I think of the blues, I... What kinds of things came out in your conversation?
New Orleans.
So places.
Uh-huh.
Any other places come out in conversation?
St. Louis.
Chicago, Memphis, New Orleans. Any place else?
Tacoma.
The Tacoma aroma makes me sing the blues.
KPLU.
Yeah, we were talking about KPLU.
Radio station. Okay,
radio
so
station.
There's a segue. There's a really important element of geography in the blues, and came out in a number of your conversations. So that's really key. And turned into KPLU. Did anyone talk about industry elements? Because that's like the blues has a geographic element, but it also has a production and distribution element to it, and radio stations are part of that dynamic. Anyone in your conversations talk about that level of the story?
Well, Blues Brothers, the movie.
Yeah, right. We're on a mission from God.
I was talking about so-and-so's awesome day in the bar where the guy stops him and said, no one leaves here without singing blues.
It has a lot of pop cultural moments. The blues have shown up in lots of different places. What else? What other kinds of things showed up in your conversation?
From the heart.
Ah, so it's a kind of expression that's from the heart. Anybody have those kinds of?
More of a plea. Yeah. From the soul.
A plea.
Modern.
What's that?
A modern lament.
A lament.
Yeah.
I don't think you can listen to or play or hear the blues without feeling something deep inside. That's my feeling. But it comes very deep.
Yeah. So there's a kind of, in a number of things that you've said, there's a kind of welling up or coming out of the depths of a person.
Evocative. Mm-hmm. The word I thought was evocative.
And sensual. Uh-huh. Sensual. Mm-hmm.
It's not passionless music. It's soul music. One person said, soul, coming out of the soul. Something up here?
Yeah, soulfulness and slavery also was an association.
So yeah, no one has said that yet. So there's a geographical connection, which is connected to an economic system in that geographic region, the South, of slavery. That's an important dynamic too, which we'll get to in a little bit. Anything else that we have that's different than what other people have said?
I think lyrics. Sometimes lyrics are what appeal to me with the melody. And a lot of jazz and blues music, in my view, don't have lyrics. They're mostly the melody.
Uh-huh.
And the lyrics bring out that for me.
So lyrics are important to you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Just
I like more just the music.
Uh-huh.
Because it allows me to put my own story. If I have the story in the music, I have to tend to follow the artist.
Uh-huh.
So if Job is set to music, it has to be
uh-huh. Job and many of the Psalms. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you had something.
We also mentioned location, not location like Memphis or whatever, but more like in bars or restaurants versus a concert in a park. I mean, it's it seemed like it was played, or at least there were early days it was played in certain locations.
Your barbecue.
I thought about barbecue.
Yeah. Yeah. How many of you have been to a barbecue place that played the blues and not Famous Dave's? Although, if you have to, you can have Famous Dave's.
That's why Famous Dave's was founded, actually.
Barbecue and the blues.
Was because of the blues.
Yeah.
And barbecue.
Yeah.
Right.
It's an interesting thing that nobody mentioned, and maybe somebody said this but didn't mention it. This whole connection to the church and the labeling of the blues as the devil's music. Have people heard that connotation about the blues?
the Ray Charles kind of connection, where he was shunned by a lot of church people because he took church music and made it kind of bluesish.
This last comment about where the blues was played is an important one, because it wasn't played in church. It was explicitly Saturday night music. It was the barbecue music. It was the juke joint. It was the communal gathering for a party. That was the music that was played there. And Robert Johnson was one of the very few in his era who was good enough and well known enough that he actually played tours where events were scheduled around him. Most of the time, people would just come out and play whatever their community gathering spot was, and people would dance and eat and drink and have a great time. And we all know what dancing leads to. So there were associations early on, partly because of the dynamic of Protestant Christianity being the dominant, Southern Baptist and Presbyterian and so forth being the dominant forms of Christianity in the South, that had a stricter divide between sacred and secular church and culture, that element of this being not church music, whether it was devil's music or not, it wasn't church music. It was music that was outside the church, and then church music was something else. Here's a image from Robert Johnson that poses this question of his relationship to the devil, and he's got the Hounds of Hell. He wrote a song called Hellhound Blues, and he's got a bottle of liquor there under his feet, and he's on the run. And so there was a I think an important intersection of things that you said that help us make sense of why it developed as a kind of music that could be called the devil's music. Part of it was this Protestant Christianity that drew a strict line between what you do in church and play in church and the kinds of things that you do outside of church or play outside of church. And it also had to do with the culture. Yeah.
I was going to say, historically it was a strong racial divide between blues and not blues. Was there not?
In the early days?
Yeah.
Like, what would be the not blues?
Well, I was thinking, when you were talking about Presbyterian and Baptist and all that, that was a really more white church versus the AME or something like that. So there was that also.
It's interesting to think about the sort of racial element of the blues, because it came out of one of the things I was going to open up is the fact that the blues emerged from the Reconstruction era, from the post-Civil War era, when there was some limited freedom for people to move, and so many of the blues songs are about traveling, and they're about the possibility of choice, of having a choice of who you have a relationship with, and of what you make of your life. And so the very fact of the blues emergence is built upon musical elements of slave culture, but it also is a development from that because of the fact that they could gather on their own. And I will read a little section from James Baldwin and another one from W.B. Du Bois in a minute that depict how difficult their life was still. But nonetheless, there's this element of freedom. But on the other hand, there was a lot of mixing among class. So poor whites and poor blacks in the Mississippi Delta region played each other's music. And one of the earliest bluesmen, Charlie Patton, who was the one who taught Robert Johnson how to play, played all kinds of music. He played gospels, he played what I would consider sort of 19th century Americana, lots of just country folk songs, not just the blues. And it wasn't really until the blues got a couple of generations later in Chicago that it became, strictly speaking, the blues and not connected in a loose way with these other genres, with spirituals and with sort of American folk songs and that sort of thing. If you look at Hank Williams, for example, who you might think of as a classic country western singer, he's singing the blues. Lots of his songs are blues songs. So you see the crossover on both sides, the black singer singing a variety of songs and the white singers singing a variety of songs. But as the 20th century moves along, it bifurcates dramatically. And the banjo is actually a great sort of icon of that division, because the banjo developed. One of the interesting ways to trace the trajectory of the blues from Africa is the instruments. And the banjo was sort of developed as a very similar instrument to some of the West African instruments. And early on, most of the blues were banjo. And it was only when white country began to adopt the banjo as their instrument and people like Robert Johnson became famous playing the guitar that you see this divide between white country playing banjo and black blues playing the guitar. And some of the, like Keb Moe and some other contemporary, what I would call intellectual blues players, people who are cognizant of the whole history of the blues and are trying to recover that, have put together an album called Reclaiming the Banjo. And it's a group of black blues musicians making the argument that the banjo is really their tie back to West Africa and ought to be a legitimate instrument for the blues. So there's a whole bunch of elements related to this relationship between white and black and their musical forms and how they influenced one another.
If you were going to switch, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'm just curious about what the context of these pictures.
Wasn't there a story about Robert Johnson selling his soul to the devil in order for it to have guitar scales or something?
Yeah. I'm gonna talk about that in just a minute.
Oh, okay.
No, it's fine. It's what I want to do first is show what happened to it, and then come back to Robert Johnson. And what happened to the blues as it moved the Great Migration up out of the South and into the northern cities, especially Chicago, electrified the blues and diversified the number of people who heard the blues. Early on, the recordings were all on what were called race labels. And so those labels only were recorded and distributed to African-American communities, and there was a network of African-American theaters, and so these musicians only played there. It wasn't until the World War II era and the city blues, B.B. King and Bo Diddley and the emergence of rock and roll, that a much wider audience. Elvis really was one of the linchpins of flipping blues from black to white and a much broader audience. But also what happened was after World War II, some of these bluesmen found out that people, young musicians in England, loved the blues and were starting blues bands. And so Eric Clapton is a great example of that. He grew up in Surrey, England, and his parents, his dad was a Canadian soldier, and his dad left right after he was born, and then he grew up with his grandparents. He never really knew his parents as parents. He never met his dad, and his mom, they pretended was his older sister, and that his grandparents were his parents. So he had this really odd childhood, and he sort of escaped the difficulty of his childhood in these blues records that he found at the store and started imitating them and trying to learn how to play the blues. And he reflects on this and says, I was attracted to how sort of countercultural they sounded, how otherworldly they sounded. So they provided for him an escape from his reality into this sort of, kind of against the system, against the difficulties of my life kind of feeling. And he became a sort of British white blues musician and joined a group called the Yardbirds. And when Sonny Boy Williamson, who was a bluesman from all the way back in the Delta in the 20s and 30s, came to England in the late 50s on this sort of swell of interest in the blues. The Yardbirds were his backing band in his tour of the UK. And so Eric Clapton here is this British white boy who has found this really strange music and fallen in love with it and is learning it, and then even playing as a backing guitar for one of these original blues players. And it becomes in Eric Clapton and in the Rolling Stones and in Led Zeppelin, these white 60s rock bands in England who grew up loving the blues and wanting to play the blues, their vehicle for anti-establishment sort of character. So this image of rock and roll as against the system, and as a sort of free space for drugs and alcohol, all of that was mixed up in their adoption of the blues as kind of a bad boy's music. And you can see that partly because of what they do with the blues. They make it their own without ever really knowing where it came from. It's almost like that movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy, where a Coke bottle falls from the sky, and they make something up with the Coke bottle, but they don't actually know what Coca-Cola is. It's not quite that dramatic, but they make something of the blues which serves their own desire to have a way to sort of sing out of their own experience of finding an alternative reality to their growing up in hardscrabble England. And the music itself oftentimes wasn't acknowledged as from these blues musicians. They, like, when you look at Led Zeppelin albums, they'll just list their names after the song, and it's a version of a classic blues song. Clapton is an exception in that regard, because he's always given credit to the blues musicians, especially Robert Johnson. But this whole idea of the blues being devil's music, being sort of music against the establishment, was attractive to them. And the real rise of the image of the blues as devil's music came from this era, from the 1960s and the blues adoption in England. And it has everything to do with what the 60s developed as in terms of a response against traditionalism and against traditional church going and against traditional values, and searching for an alternative space to say there's something else for us to explore. And so when they take on the mythology that Dave was talking about, with Robert Johnson making a pact with the devil, they're drawing on this myth from that he and other early bluesmen told about themselves, that they met the devil at the crossroads and got their prowess, not only their guitar skill but also sort of manliness from this exchange with the devil. And they read it in their own context as this real exchange with the devil. But Diane this morning in Bible study was talking about the midwives in Exodus, and they're sort of playing the trickster with Pharaoh, in a way tricking Pharaoh for the sake of the freedom of the Hebrew babies who were supposed to be killed. And in early African American culture, they were drawing on West African ideas of the trickster god, who was more like an uncle who would help you if you needed help, and you could make a deal with the trickster, and the trickster would give you what you needed in order to succeed. But if the deal you made with the trickster wasn't kept, then the trickster would cause you trouble. So Legba is the name of this trickster god in West African religion, and that idea is not the conception of Protestant Christianity's devil. So the mythology in the context of the Delta and African American culture had a really different connotation than what it became in terms of anti-establishment, even the beginnings of what I would call the rumors about rock and roll and Satan And if you play Led Zeppelin record backwards or a Beatles record backwards, it will say, "Worship Satan," or whatever they said they would say. So I just want to play a brief clip of Robert Johnson's version, or of Eric Clapton's version of Robert Johnson's song, Crossroad. And then we're going to look at Robert Johnson's song, and I want you to talk together about the song itself when you hear it and see the lyrics, and say to yourself, is this song, Crossroads Blues, about the devil, or what is the song about? And we'll try and sort that out together when you take away the myth and just look at the song that supposedly is the root of the myth of Robert Johnson going to the crossroads and exchanging his soul. So here's a little bit of Eric Clapton with his band Cream playing Crossroad. Their use of the guitar as a voice. And that's a connection, I think, to the emotionality of the blues. And it's something I hope later in the week Paul and I will talk about, because there's, in the early blues musicians, no theory at all, no musical training at all, other than apprenticeship. They would apprentice themselves to another musician. And the same thing Eric Clapton, although he didn't have access to the musicians, played their records and played his guitar along with the records over and over and over again, trying to apprentice himself to these early blues musicians. So he didn't start out with any formal musical training at all either. It was just all imitation. And that's an interesting difference, an important difference, I think, in the way that the blues have influenced American and global popular music, coming out of, in a sense, the soul or the gut or your emotions, and trying to express that musically rather than having a theoretical understanding of music and tonal systems and so forth and making music out of that. He clearly was appreciated. This is a famous graffiti in London. And it's an interesting shift in the religiosity of 60s and 70s rock, that they became gods themselves. So the blues had a different kind of religiosity by the time we get to this era. It's partly a famous photo because of how bizarre it is to have this crabby lady and the dog taking a leak on the wall where it says Clapton's dog. Crossroad Blues was written by Robert Johnson, we think. There's no earlier record of it or recording of it, but he learned to play guitar from Charlie Patton. He lived on this cotton plantation, the Dockery Plantation in Mississippi, and he recorded quite a bit, like I said, across American folk songs, gospel songs, blues songs, and was half Cherokee and half African American. You can see the distinctive look he has. And was known for being a virtuoso on the guitar, but also a really lively performer, sometimes playing the guitar behind his head, behind his back. So they were showmen, too. And because of that, now that more research has been done on this story and lots of oral interviews that were done with the Library of Congress field research in the 30s and 40s, Al Lomax in particular, we know more about Charlie Patton and his presence in that area and teaching younger musicians Sun House and Robert Johnson and Muddy Waters, some of these blues names that we know now. And this is just a couple of images of what that region is like then. This is Muddy Waters on the Stovall plantation with a fellow whose name we don't know playing music on the porch. And this is the only other picture we have of Robert Johnson. His fingers are remarkable, very long fingers. And here's the lyric for the song. And I just want you to take a minute and read through the song and then talk for a minute to the person next to you about, a couple people next to you about, what is this song about? What is it really trying to say? It follows the classic blues pattern of first verse repeated in the, or first line repeated in the second line and then a third line that's different. But it's like most blues, it doesn't always follow that standard pattern. It's playing in the background so you can hear it as you're reading the lyrics. Read through, go ahead and turn to your neighbor and talk it over together and see what sense you can make of what's the story the song is telling. All right, let's talk together about this and see what sense we make of it. First of all, is this devil's music?
No, it doesn't seem to be. It's like a prayer.
When you just start, let's just talk through it together. When you start with the first verse, what reaction do you have to it? What's going on in the first verse?
It's a prayer.
It's a cry. It's a plea.
And he's at a critical point. He's at a crossroads. He doesn't know where to go.
Yeah.
Man, he's depressed.
Yeah.
So it's like what many of you said right from the start. There's an emoting. There's a soulfulness, a heartfulness that's coming out. It's not just matter of fact. Oh well, something's at stake here. We don't know quite what yet. So the second verse gives us a little more information about what's at stake. What's going on? What do you think? What does that say to you?
Asking for help.
Nobody there to help him.
He's blind and he's left out.
Yeah.
He feels like the guy that lying on the side of the road in the Good Samaritan story, but the Good Samaritan doesn't come along.
Yeah. And it says something just built into the song about socioeconomic position. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a car. You know, he just doesn't go out, take the keys and go out, get in the car and drive off to wherever he's going. He's depending on the goodwill of somebody who has a car or a truck to stop and give him a ride to where he's trying to get to. But it does represent that era of mobility. He is trying to get there. He's out. And so there's this tension of that point in African American history of having some freedom but incredible limits. Because of the limitation of their capacity to have the resources. Okay, how about the third verse? What does that get us further in understanding something about what's going on?
He's there all day long. The rising sun is going down. He's there all day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nowhere to lay his head.
That was confusing to me. Rising sun going down. You think of sundown going down. Yeah. I don't think of rising sun.
That makes, that's, there's the image of the whole day.
It's all day.
But everything's smooth.
Like a four-word together.
See, I got the crossroads.
So why does the sun going down cause him to be sinking down?
He's been at the crisis a long time, and there's no solution.
Yeah.
There's not going to be any more rides.
Well, and also, yeah, maybe no more rides.
Also, you pointed out that he said that the sun's going down. He doesn't have a place to lay his head. I mean, you're more vulnerable at night, having hitchhiked in my younger days. I remember that feeling of not getting a ride.
Yeah.
Well, just in the south, to be standing where the roads come together looking for a ride is a single African-American man flagging a ride, you're not getting one, and the sun's going down, you're going to be lynched. I mean, it's, you're not supposed to be out there.
In the south, they have, they call them sundown communities. Literally, that's what they call them. And you can't be there at sundown for the African-American. And it's like, they still have those, like in the, when I was in South Carolina. So.
And if it's daylight, you might be able to see somewhat who's coming. Mm-hmm. At night, you're just going to see two headlights and have no idea who it is that's coming down the road. So if they do stop, you don't know what that means, that they're stopping.
When was this written?
He recorded it in the mid-20s. So I'm guessing that it was some version of a song that he learned that just hadn't been recorded before. So I would think probably in that first 20 years of the 1900s. Next verse. You can run, tell my friend Willie Brown. I don't know who Willie Brown is, but there's a kind of, to me, in that verse, there's a kind of, I gotta have help from somebody. He's reaching out to people who might help him.
Emergency.
You gotta get my friend, because I'm in trouble here. And the last verse? We never knew why he's trying to get somewhere.
Yeah.
And the last verse, maybe, maybe it was a relationship thing, a breakup or some trouble with his girlfriend, and he was trying to get to her or away from her. A lot of the blues songs are about the joys and sorrows of relationships, mm-hmm. and their breakups and their happiness when things are happy. There's a whole genre of the blues that's just sexual innuendo. Mm-hmm. Good party songs. So taken as a whole, it gives you a picture of a certain kind of prayerfulness, a certain kind of desperation about the person's plight, and a sense of the time. Built into the song is a sense of the time and the place that the song was written. And so one of the things that I take away from just listening to the song and listening to it in music and lyrics is getting at the inherent religiosity of the blues. Because, like many of you said, they're a genre that lets us speak the truth about our lives. Mm-hmm. I want to read you just a couple sentence description of the blues by Henry Townsend, who was a contemporary of Robert Johnson. Some people think that the blues is something that is evil. I don't. If the blues is delivered in the truth, which most of them are, if I sing the blues and tell the truth, what have I done? What have I committed? I haven't lied. And that claim that the blues are truth-telling, are singing the truth of our lives, to me is a way of connecting to cries of Scripture, something we picked up in Bible study this morning, that the cries of the people are heard by God. It's one of the fundamental testimonies in Scripture from that sort of central story of the Israelites crying out in slavery and God hearing them, and the psalmist crying out, "How long, O Lord?" So that characteristic of speaking the truth of our lives, whether it's crying out in sorrow or suffering, or whether it's crying out in ecstasy and joy, that truthfulness is a part of what I think is so religious about the blues, and so similar to some of our scriptural witness about what it is to live faithfully before God. This is James Baldwin writing in the 1940s about the blues. He says, "In all jazz, and especially in the blues, there's something tart and ironic, authoritative and double-edged. White Americans seem to feel that happy songs are happy and sad songs are sad, and that, God help us, is exactly the way most white Americans sing them, sounding in both cases so helplessly, defenselessly fatuous that no one dare speculate on the temperature of the deep freeze from which issue their brave and sexless little voices." He's not mincing any words here. Only people who have been down the line, as the song puts it, know what this music is about. I think it was Big Bill Brunzi, who used to sing "I Feel So Good," a really joyful song about a man who is on his way to the railroad station to meet his girl. She's coming home. It is the singer's incredibly moving exuberance that makes one realize how leaden the time must have been while she was gone. There's no guarantee that she will stay this time either, as the singer clearly knows, and in fact, she has not yet actually arrived. Tonight, or tomorrow, or within the next 5 minutes, he may be very well singing "Lonesome in My Bedroom," or insisting, ain't we gonna make it all right? Well, if we don't today, will we tomorrow night? White Americans do not understand the depths out of which such ironic tenacity comes, but they suspect that the force is sensual, and they are terrified of sensuality, and do not any longer understand it. The word sensual is not intended to bring to mind quivering dusky maidens or black studs. I'm referring to something much simpler and much less fanciful. To be sensual, I think, is to respect and rejoice in the force of life itself, and to be present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to breaking of bread. It will be a great day, incidentally, when we begin to eat bread again instead of that blasphemous and tasteless foam rubber we have substituted for it. And I'm not being frivolous now either. Something very sinister happens to the people of a country when they begin to distrust their own reactions as deeply as they do here, and become as joyless as they have become. This is the individual uncertainty on the part of white American men and women, this inability to renew themselves at the fountain of their own lives, that makes the discussion, let alone elucidation of any conundrum, that is, any reality, so extremely difficult. He's really making the case that the blues teaches us how to tell the truth about our lives, all of the truth, and passionately. And that kind of cry is the cry, I think, the blues and scripture teach us to make, and it's when music matters to us, that's why it matters to us. And I think while we could spend a lot of time on it, I just want to very quickly highlight what happened in Tommy Dorsey's life that led to Precious Lord, and that let us finish by talking a little bit about songs that mark our deepest and most profound moments. He started out in Atlanta. His dad was a sharecropper and itinerant preacher, and his mom was a church musician. And so he grew up loving music and loving the Lord. But they moved to Atlanta when he was a young boy, and he got connected to the vibrant African-American culture on Auburn Street and the 81 Theater there, and blues musicians were coming through. And he met Ma Rainey. And heard her music and got just totally inspired by this vibrant music. And so he began taking lessons, and he went to Chicago with many, many other people with the promise and hope of a better future, and went to a music college there. And was playing in bars, and Ma Rainey heard him this time and said, hey, you've got a great band. Will you come be my band on tour? And so this is Ma Rainey, who many people call the mother of the blues, and her Georgia Wildcats. And that's Thomas Dorsey down there on the end playing the piano. And so he played the blues with Ma Rainey for probably 10 years before his uncle, who he was in Chicago living with, took him to a Pilgrim Baptist Church to a revival. And he heard a early version of a connection between the gospel and the blues, and was really moved by it, moved by that bringing of the blues into the church. And so he began to explore that and began writing that music that would bring together church music and the gospel music and the blues, and had a very hard time selling it because everyone considered it to be that music we don't play in church, the Saturday night music, the music of the bars. And slowly this built up in his own church, and his choir sang at a convention and blew people away, and it just slowly grew as people felt like it expressed something that was true about their lives, and they were drawn to it for that reason, that it could express their sorrow as well as their joy. And he tells the story in this brief recording of the origin of Precious Lord, and it's beautiful to hear him tell it. So let me play him telling what happened.
St. Louis one morning to work in a revival. I left my wife asleep in bed, got in the car and went along. She was going to become a mother, and I was anticipating a great happiness and great joy on my return. But I got to St. Louis, and about the second night in the meeting, a telegram boy came and brought me a telegram. I opened it and read, your wife just died. Come home. I couldn't finish the meeting. Finally, I got home to Chicago the next morning. And it was so. I found it all true. I had never moved the body. And that killed me off. I wanted to go back to blues. But after putting my wife away, it had been the same casket. I went to the old Oral College. Music room there, Brown and I, just rosing over the keys. And seemingly the words, like drops of water from the crevice of a rock above, seemed to drop in line with me on the piano. Precious Lord, take my hand. Lead me on. Let me stand. I'm tired. I'm weak. I'm worn. Through the storm, through the night. Lead me on to the light. Take my hand, precious Lord, and lead me on. Now, God has blessed. I have another family. I have a wife, son, a daughter, and a grandson about 7, 8 years old. And the Lord has led me, and he will lead you. And I hope, some way, somehow, if you don't sing, precious Lord, take my hand, you will learn to sing. And sing it with the feeling and the fervor. God bless you and keep you.
Gracious.
Obviously, that song has been a powerful song for many other people since he wrote it, including being sung at Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral because it was his favorite hymn. And many people argue part of the reason it's such a powerful hymn in places of struggle is because it comes musically and culturally out of his experience with songs, blues songs that have that as their deep sense. And so I just wanted to take our last few minutes and if anyone is willing to share, what songs for you are that kind of song that either in a particular moment of suffering or joy, or when you need a song to carry you through a time, you turn to it. What is that song? Are there songs that do that for you, or songs that you go to in moments of difficulty or in moments of elation? Songs that sing your life, as my teacher Don Saliers puts it.
Amazing Grace.
Yeah, so something you want to say about that? Yeah. Amazing Grace would be a fascinating case study because it comes out of the experience of slavery and repentance. I mean, it's connected in some interesting ways to this story.
It's like you're sinful and you're not perfect, so you're doing things that are not right. Amazing Grace comes to me, how God's grace will be your forgiveness because of His grace.
Yeah, it's actually an honest song that admits the depth of brokenness. Other ones, what else?
Be Thou My Vision.
So what about that one?
Well, I particularly it's one that that gives me a lot of comfort, but what really got me is when I heard what's his name? Drawing a blank. Popular musician who turned it around.
David, what's his name? He did it as when his band's name was Pedro the Lion. But there's a Seattle singer who did a version of Be Thou My Vision, but I don't know. It's Sufjan Stevens did it too.
It was done in a Celtic style.
Oh, that might have been.
Yeah, could have been Sufjan Stevens. Yeah. He did a version of it that's like that. That's really powerful, beautiful.
Yeah. It just speaks to me.
Yeah. Other, yeah, in the back.
This might seem like a stretch, but for me, opera, certain opera arias are like giant hypodermic needles of emotion directly to my heart. They do to me the same thing that the blues do, because there's no irony. They're vulnerable, and the emotion is so out there. They're so out on the end of a limb.
Yeah.
Often. So if I'm not feeling very much, I will be feeling it with that music.
Yeah. I can think of a particular instance of that. In fact, in who knows. Opera, Faust, where he's lost his soul and he's about to be reclaimed. Mm. And
so these are composed things.
The last aria is just total giving up to fate,
right,
and total redemption.
So they're different, they're opposite, because in a sense this is a folk tradition, this is as not composed, not artifice tradition, but to me they get the same, something like the same place, like a crossroads of emotion.
Yeah. They're all in the art.
I think it's important to remember that the blues did develop a form, and it gave it a kind of musical place in terms of musical theory, and as it's developed and people have begun to write blues music, I think it's, and if you take the thread of blues that went into the jazz tradition, it's even more complicated in terms of music theory and so forth. We're at time, and so I just want to say in conclusion that the answer for me to that question of devil's music or faithful cry is a claim that any human cry out of the honesty of our experience is a way to pray faithfully to God, and it's what Scripture does at its heart. It allows the human cry to be authentic and real.
Call the thing what it is.
Yeah.
Theology.
And so I think the blues actually have gotten a bad rap when they've been called devil's music, and I think working to recover the history and culture and context of the blues helps us to see their deep character as faithful ways to cry out to God. So I'm glad you came. Thanks for talking with me about this. It's a passion of mine. And I have a book about this kind of stuff called Broken Hallelujahs, which deals with some of this material, and it's in the bookstore this week. So if it interests you, you're welcome to pick that up and read some more.
Do you have the music of the bookstore? I mean, do you have it there?
I
so wanted to hear it.
You can't leave us hanging like that.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still on here though. Thanks for coming though.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jocelyn.
Jocelyn.
Woo!